Welcome to Oncology Today, the role of bispecific antibodies in the management of multiple myeloma. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Joshua Richter from the Tisch Cancer Institute, Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York. In addition to this interview, there's also a video recording featuring Dr. Richter's full-length slide presentation. To begin, I asked him to comment on a central issue in the use of bispecifics and CAR-T, the practical management of cytokine release syndrome.
The International Myeloma Working Group just released recent guidelines along these measures that it's a very reasonable thing to consider dexamethasone as your first line of therapy for CRS. So I work with a lot of emergency rooms to try to educate them about how to manage this, because I think right now our ERs and community hospitals will say, all right, here comes Mrs. Smith. She has myeloma. She has a fever. Let's give her vancomycin, vancomycin, cultures in mid to the floor. We need to start thinking about these toxicities, and not everyone's going to have tocilizumab, cetuximab, and Anakinra. So I think the approach that I would say to a lot of patients is, if you don't know, we manage these, in my mind, like COPD. How many COPD exacerbations do you give? Some steroids and antibiotics to cover both. We often do this in some of our patients. So starting off with dex is not a problem if you don't have tocilizumab. It's very effective, always available. And for patients with diabetes, typically the steroids that are used are only going to be for usually somewhere between one dose or a day or two. So if during that time we provide a sliding scale coverage, it typically will settle down once we're done with the steroids.
Yeah, that kind of leads into where things are now and where things are heading, particularly in terms of bispecifics as it relates to myeloma. I was kind of flashing on the fact you were talking about the survival, overall survival benefits that's been seen with these agents, which we didn't see with transplant, which I think is kind of a message, I think a little bit, but anyhow, we can maybe talk a little bit about that later. Another thing I was kind of flashing on before we kind of get into taking care of patients and your cases is I had a little bit of a flashback to the day that teclistamab was approved. I think it was in the fall of 2022. And at that point, we were doing a program where we were doing some interviews of patients. So on the day that teclistamab was approved, I interviewed a patient, a Dr. Berdeja, who'd been on it for a year and a half, doing great, no symptoms, in remission. And I also interviewed a woman who'd been on belantamab for 4 years at about the time, right after it was discontinued, sort of, bringing up the issue of what's it take to get stuff approved and continued to approve. But I guess it's also a statement about, and it really, you mentioned it, the real value to patients of clinical trials. I mean, Sagar Lonial's presenting cases to me for years. Just like you said, people go from one trial to the other trial. They never stop going on trials. Any thoughts about that and trying to bring that paradigm into the community?
Yeah, so I think the reality is the general statement of until we have a 100% cure for 100% of patients 100% of the time, clinical trials are a vital part of our strategy. And in myeloma, they're actually exactly as you pointed out. We have a limited number of therapies. So if I can take a patient and insert a treatment of a drug potentially years before approval, if we're wrong, we still have every therapy after that. And if we're right, we potentially gain them years. But something that you've been alluding to, which I think is a major issue, is that a lot of these are often confined to the academic ivory towers. And not only does this confine it to a certain socioeconomic group of patients sometimes, but it also limits availability to other racial and ethnic groups that may not have the same access to a lot of these novel therapies. So one of the things that we've been really engaging with is trying to port out clinical trials to as many satellite sites, that it doesn't have to just be, in the, 30-floor academic tower, that using things like centralized CROs and working with some centralized data and research staff, but then expanding access out to community centers to provide these type of therapies. This is crucial to make sure that everybody benefits from these advances, not just the select few.
Yeah, I want to talk to you more about that later, but just before we get into your cases and really starting to get into the practical issues that are going on, I have to tell you that as you were talking, for some reason, I flashed on a program we did at the AUA on prostate cancer, and they were talking about treating biochemical recurrent disease, which is really early metastatic, you know, PSA disease, and they've had these wild trials now that are going out and, you know, tried intensifying hormonal therapy, different kinds of hormonal therapy. And one of the docs there, you know, kind of was talking about his vision for the future. And he said, you know, we're going to be using more intermittent therapy, stop and go, treat, and they get in remission, let them go off therapy using, you know, they don't necessarily need MRD because they have PSA. And the other thing he was talking about was, you know, everybody was trying to separate out all the hormonal agents. He was like, they're all really the same. And if one patient doesn't tolerate one, I know there's not a trial, but I flip to the other one. And I'm like, that kind of makes sense. That's like almost a chronic disease model. Do you think that's maybe where we're heading here?
Absolutely. Especially in the realm of bispecifics, because there's two things that we know happen with long-term bispecifics. One is that, as opposed to CAR T, where the immune suppression comes on and then goes away, and patients regain their immune systems to a degree, the rates of infection go down. But with chronic administration of bispecifics, that rate of infection just keeps going up and up. It doesn't go away. The other is that if you're telling your T cells, fight, 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 and there's nobody to fight, they start to get exhausted. And when you need them to fight, they may not be ready. So I think your concept here is exactly the future of myeloma, where we give a fixed duration of a bispecific, either a fixed number of cycles, or we target MRD negativity, or, you know, kind of an old-fashioned solid tumor, two cycles beyond our deep response. Then we monitor them off therapy so that, A, in the treatment-free period, they don't have the same adverse events and infections, and B, when they relapse, because ultimately everyone unfortunately will right now, their T cells are hardy and recovered and ready to fight again.
Again, I could bring up CLL as another evolution, I think, in a similar direction. So let's ask some basic questions that everybody's asking. They keep hearing, now you're talking about bispecifics I haven't even heard about, although we do programs like this pretty frequently. So I guess the first question everybody wants to know is, you know, it's always tough to compare things indirectly, but any sense about whether any of these is more effective?
So, I think right now we group the BCMAs and the non-BCMAs a little bit separately. So, we have elranatamab and teclistamab, which seem to be very, very similar. I don't think we have an inclination as to which one is better. There's some wonderful work that's being done in the lab to try to figure out, based on certain mutations of BCMA antigen, which one may be better, but that's not really ready for prime time. And even, you know, at centers like mine, we don't test this before we give it to a patient. So, you know, to me, this is like right now with elranatamab and teclistamab, it's like chocolate and vanilla ice cream. You may like chocolate a little better. I may like vanilla a little better, to be honest. If we're getting ice cream, we're getting ice cream, and I'm happy either way. So whatever your institution is set up for, give that drug. Talquetamab is a little bit harder of a drug to tolerate long term. But I think one of the advantages of it is that if you're thinking about giving a BCMA CAR T in the future, I would tend to give talquetamab now so that we preserve the BCMA antigen for the CAR T cell later.
Interesting. And I guess the other thing is tolerability, quality of life, inconvenience. You know, sub-Q certainly stands out a little bit. But again, how would you, you know, across the board compare tolerability within class?
Yeah. So I think the BCMA bispecific antibodies are generally a little bit easier to tolerate. Most of their toxicity is heme-related. And once you get through it a little bit, it tends to be okay. One of the things that we're learning from these drugs is that these are not necessarily dose-dependent toxicity. So when people were on lenalidomide, you come in on cycle 15 and your counts are low, you reduce the dose from 25 to 15 and everyone's fine. Dose reductions don't seem to help these toxicities. It's dose holds. So I think we learned this with belantamab and we learned it with these drugs that you don't drop from 1.5 to 0.6 mg per kg. You just hold the dose for a week or two and let the toxicities settle out. And then actually you can increase from weekly to every other week to monthly dosing. For talquetamab, the big toxicity long term, again, the skin stuff goes away very easily with emollients and vitamin E oils for lotions for the nails. The dysgeusia, we haven't had a good answer just yet, but we've just launched the Talisman study, which is evaluating different modalities of things like steroid swishes and swallows or clonazepam swishes and swallows, trying to figure out a way that we can all better have our patients tolerate these drugs long term.
So along the same lines, where do you see CAR T fitting in? You know, it clearly doesn't seem to be exactly following the route of diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, which I guess people were hoping in the beginning. But with this more of a chronic long-term disease MRD-guided strategy, do you think we're moving towards just bispecifics or like CAR T followed, or, you know, do you think they might end up sequencing?
So these are like all of the key hot topics right now. So following the recent FDA decision that has actually moved the CAR Ts up front, so right now bispecifics are approved after fourth line, with cilta-cel being approved after first line, and ide-cel being approved after third line and above. Right now we have the ability to give CAR Ts before bispecifics. I think when CAR Ts were curative in diseases like leukemia and lymphoma, we assumed that there'd be a curative modality in myeloma, and the air came out of our tires a little bit when that didn't happen. But is there a sequence or a combination of these that could lead to cure? I'm excited about that. I'm excited about trials like the CARTITUDE-6 study, which are saying, you know, should we give a transplant up front or should we be giving a CAR T up front? You know, it also wouldn't surprise me if the answer is induction, a transplant, and then a CAR T to wipe away what's left. Maybe that is a curative approach. So right now, I think the wonders of CAR Ts is that they provide this great treatment-free interval. The problem is CAR Ts still require an academic center, manufacturing time. So if you have someone who shows up to your clinic on a Friday afternoon with renal failure and progressive disease, it's still by specific time that you can give that day and start getting their disease under control.
Incidentally, you have a great use of analogies. I thought you might appreciate one of my more favorite ones. Rich Stone from Dana-Farber said that MDS is like, the bone marrow is like a factory where all the workers are drunk.
I've learned so much from him about IgG4-related disease. He's such a good guy.
Yeah. Anyhow, he's a big analogy person too. Anyhow, why don't we get into your cases here. And, you know, one of the things I want to get into with these cases is how you would see potentially, theoretically, involving a community-based oncologist in a case like that. Like right now, ideally, what would you do and what would they do if it was, let's say, they sent the patient to you, for example. So let's keep that in mind as we talk about your cases. Why don't we start with this first one?
Sure. So let's get started with the first case. So this is a 65-year-old female with IgA lambda plus lambda myeloma. And when we use that terminology, that means, you know, they have an IgA lambda M spike of maybe 0.5. So a little bit of an M spike, but the majority of their disease, you know, they have a lambda of like 1,000. So we call that IgA lambda plus lambda. Diagnosed in 2011, Dury-Salmon stage 3A. We didn't have full cytogenetics. Has gone through all of the, you know, the general therapies, you know, induction, transplant, and is now penta-refractory. So refractory to lenalidomide, pomalidomide, bortezomib, carfilzomib, and daratumumab, and ultimately went on to receive therapy with linvoseltamab.
Can I just ask before you go on, before you kind of get more deeper into the case, I'm just curious, this is a real patient, I guess, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I'm just kind of curious.
Modified a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah, modified for anonymity or whatever you want to do, you know. But I guess the one thing I was curious about is what this particular patient, and again, you can make it up if this is a synthesis of your people, but I was just more curious about her attitude toward being in a trial. Is that why she came to see you, or you were taking care of her from the beginning?
No, she ended up, you know, I think your sentiment here is a very important one, is that I think there are certain practices where the culture of the patients is enrollment into clinical trials. I think Sagrolonial has developed a wonderful sentiment of that at Emory, and our patients have the same thing where the myeloma patients will come and saying, okay, what trials are available to me? And they become excited, not just to help themselves, but to eventually contribute to, you know, the overall understanding of the disease.
What were some of the things you talked about with her before you put her on the trial? I guess at that point, you really didn't know that much about the specific drug, but kind of more what was goes on with the class effect.
Yeah. So, you know, we also have to start with everything of that, you know, this drug is still on clinical trials. So we don't know if this drug will work in you or not. But we started, you know, from prior BCMA therapies that have been out there and in others in clinical trial, that this was a very exciting area that we knew that even patients who had progressed beyond a lot of our standard drugs, we already were seeing, even at low doses of these therapies, responses. And it's something that's strange. You know, I think we were used to the old days of chemotherapy trials where the first X number of patients got subtherapeutic doses and they didn't really have side effects, but they didn't really respond. But with immune therapies, to me, this is like the Malcolm Gladwell tipping point that sometimes you only need a little bit to kick off their immune system over the edge. And some of these patients, even though the phase two dose was 200 milligrams, we had some patients on the study at 5 milligrams who were in remission for years.
Wow. Fascinating. We'll see what happened with this lady.
Sure.
This is so, 10 years into her diagnosis too.
Yeah. Right? So 10 years into her diagnosis. Yeah. No, absolutely. Amazing. And we start off with therapy with linvoseltamab. And this is where I want to get granular because this is where the timing really comes in. Because I think as these drugs move their way into the community, a kind of understanding of when the problems are likely to happen and what kind of coverage we need at night. So we gave her cycle 1 day 1 infusion. It completed around, a little after 1:20 in the afternoon. Baseline vitals were fine. Blood pressure was good. Heart rate, oxygen saturation, and I included the ICE score. The ICE score is our way of evaluating for ICONS or neurotoxicity, 10 out of 10 being normal, any decline from that being signs of ICONS. CRP and ferritin were a little on the higher side, but, you know, essentially normal. Patient had no complaints. Later on that evening at around 9 o'clock, the patient on routine vitals, again, this is in the hospital setting. So right now we're doing the majority of our step-ups in the hospital. Routine vitals, the patient starts to have a little bit of a low-grade temp. Heart rate's fine, pulse is fine, ICE 10 out of 10. The patient feels a little warm, but is otherwise no issues. Nurse calls me and I said, no, let's just keep an eye on it. But, you know, recheck the vitals in about an hour or so and give me a call. And they did. And about an hour and a half later, now the patient has a real temperature, 102.1. Blood pressure is down a little bit. The patient is now tachycardic. Oxygen sat is a little down. Again, we're still in the good 90s. ICE is 10 out of 10, but the patient is starting to have, you know, some kind of mild rigors. And they drew labs, which, of course, we didn't get at the moment, but we got them back in retrospect. The CRP was starting to elevate, knowing that CRP is driven mainly by IL-6. Ferritin was starting to go up. Again, that's mainly driven by IL-1. But our first approach was to say, listen, this patient is having CRS. It's climbing in grade. We administered tocilizumab, Tylenol to help with the symptomatic fever. And again, between the insensible losses, the tachycardia, the lower blood pressure, we gave a bolus of normal saline. And ultimately, upon repeat vitals within later that evening and early the next morning, the fever went away. The vital signs returned to normal. And we proceeded with the rest of the step-up doses for this patient without additional subsequent CRS events. And again, one of the benefits of using tocilizumab is it has such a long half-life. It's kind of like Ender's Game. It fights the CRS now and will prevent it later on because it's already on board in the system. And this patient actually remains in complete remission on linvoseltamab.
Do you get any more information by doing an MRD assay at this point? Or at the, you know, after treatment?
So the short answer is probably. You know, unfortunately, on trial, even if the patient is MRD negative, we can't hold and then restart. But your point is the future of this, which is taking a patient like this with commercial drug, evaluating either 1 point of MRD or 2 points sustained MRD, and saying, listen, why don't we just stop and observe you off of therapy? And I think one of the people who's leading a great trial is Al Garfall at UPenn, who has a study that he calls Limitech, where he looks at patients who've achieved deep responses after induction and then randomizes them to continue or stop, so we can hopefully figure out who we can stop.
One other thing I was curious about is how much of a problem is hypoxemia in CRS?
So it's one of those that's subtle. It tends not to be an issue with lower grade CRS. First of all, grade one is just a fever. And in grade two, you start to see some alterations. But, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, vital signs are vital. So when you get a call from the nurse and they're like, oh, you know, the pulse is this and the blood pressure is that. No, no. For all these patients, you got to ask what the O2 sat is. You got to ask what the ICE score is, because the early little drops can be a hint of something in the future if you don't put your foot down. So it's very vital to make sure that you're not slipping off the curve.
The other thing is, at least on this trial, and maybe you could just comment in general, what do you do in terms of preemptive anti-infectives when you start therapy?
Yeah, so what we've noted is several things. One is HSV prophylaxis is pretty much given on almost every drug in myeloma except monotherapy IMIDs. The other is we've learned that IVIG needs to be part of this upfront, especially for BCMA bispecifics, with one caveat, remembering that when you're starting these drugs, patients are typically progressing. So if you have a patient starting this drug who has an IgG of 7,000, that's not the time to add more IgG to the system and put them at risk for hyperviscosity. So if they have a high IgG, even if it's non-functional, we give them a cycle or so to get their IgG down and then add the IVIG. The other thing that's crucial is we've seen a resurgence of pneumocystis pneumonia. You know, it was the old days of myeloma where we're giving pulse dex 4 days on, 4 days off, where we see pneumocystis all the time. And as we lowered our dexamethasone, PJP went away. But now, as we're basically redirecting T cells, we're turning these patients into functional HIV and AIDS patients, taking away their T cells against fighting infection. We've seen a resurgence of PJP. So we start them all on either Mepron or trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole up front. If you have the ability to give inhaled pentamidine, you absolutely can. Most of our patients end up getting Mepron, the ugly yellow paint, because, you know, we always worry a little bit about Bactrim in patients with bad kidneys or bad counts, which describes almost every advanced myeloma patient.
All right, let's take a look at your next case, a 62-year-old lady.
Absolutely. So this is one that I think brings up a kind of subtle but very important new adverse event that we're seeing a lot in T-cell redirection therapy. So this is a 62-year-old female, again, with IgA lambda myeloma, also diagnosed more than a decade ago, now penta-refractory, and went on to therapy with teclistamab in a very standard approach. And she started off with the 0.06 mg per kg first step-up dose. Tolerated it well on day one, but on day two, all of a sudden, she reports severe pain in her right upper arm. Her vitals are stable. She's afebrile. ICE is 10 out of 10. There's no evidence of CRS. There's no evidence of ICONS, but excruciating pain in the right upper arm. And I want to show you her former imaging just before starting therapy. And if you look in her right shoulder, the proximal right humerus, you can see this FDG avid mass, basically an in situ plasmacytoma. And one of the things that we've started to recognize is tumor flare has become a major issue. And the concept is that's an area that, let's say, is a focal area in the marrow that's 80% filled with plasma cells. Now you activate all these T cells that rush into the area, fill the tumor that's now expanding and pressing on the inside of the bone. And this almost is like the litmus test of where do you have myelomatous infiltration in your body? Because where there's T cells go, they'll expand the area, and we're starting to see pain and tumor flare. So we diagnosed her as having tumor flare, and the treatment of this is to give steroids. We gave her a dose of dexamethasone, and literally within a few hours, the pain goes away. And it's important to recognize this because I think our first jump is to give some type of opioid-based narcotic. But the answer here is not to give escalating doses of morphine or Dilaudid, but to quiet down the focal inflammation which we did. Once it quieted down on day three, we were able to give the next step up dose. And this patient, again, this time had pain, but in the setting of fever, a temperature to 102.1, tachycardic, sitting well on room air, had some pain. It wasn't as bad as before, but was clearly developing some component of CRS. And this was a case where I decided to shoot with both barrels. So we gave the tocilizumab for the CRS and the dexamethasone to do double duty, to do the duty of helping to treat the non-IL-6 driven CRS and to help with some of the recurrent pain in the arm before it got too bad. Ultimately, this quieted down the fever, it quieted down the pain, and we're able to complete the rest of the step up without any recurrent CRS or tumor flare. And just to note, these are some of her trends in some inflammatory markers, and we can clearly see here, particularly with the CRP, you know, we're able to run real-time cytokine monitoring, but that's not going to be available at a lot of institutions. But CRP and ferritin are readily available at all institutions. And, you know, as you're doing step up, we do check it daily because it gives us a hint. You know, if that CRP is starting to rise, you may be heading towards a CRS or an ICONS-like event. And we can see here, once the tocilizumab and the steroids were given, that CRP dropped down. It peaked at over 100 and settled down to be around 8.
That's an incredible story. I never heard about that complication. Like, where do you see it? And is it always pain? Do you ever get, like, you know, compression of an organ, rupture or something like that?
So we haven't seen any organ rupture, and it's almost always pain. And it's just always worthwhile. Again, I wish I could always do this with a retrospectoscope, looking through someone's imaging before we admit them. But what usually ends up happening is someone either in the back or the legs or the hips, just all of a sudden, it's usually during the step-up dosing, that initial rush of T cells, they get tumor flare. And we're starting to see this fairly commonly.
But I mean, tumor flare, you know, one thing if it's symptomatic like pain, but you don't see objective, like progressions, just pain.
No. Oh, so sorry. Apologies. No. So we're not seeing this kind of pseudo progression where you get a local flare, but taking a step back, there have been a couple of cases where when patients had pain, we did image them, and it's unclear if in that initial setting, if you have a very short interval scan and the tumor is the same or maybe a hair bigger, that may be a component of it. We don't image these. By the time we normally re-image them, they've already had an improvement in tumor bulk. But when we do those short intervals, we have seen a few of those cases, yes.
There's a big debate with the checkpoint inhibitors about whether people get autoimmune toxicity, have greater efficacy. I don't know if there are enough patients who have pain, but this lady seems to do pretty well, that's for sure.
Absolutely. You know, I have think that we're looking for a reason to tell patients, you know, much like with some of the antibodies, oh, when you got the rash, that means you're going to do right. Amazing. If you get pain, right. You're going to do amazing. We don't know, but it probably does mean at some level that your immune system is cranked up and ready to fight.
Yeah, that brings back memories, too, of EGFR. That's the way they initially, there's nothing to measure. So that was before they were using TKIs before they knew what they were doing. Anyhow, let's hear about your last case, the 68-year-old man.
Sure. So this is a 68-year-old man who has IgG kappa myeloma. And, you know, this is his treatment paradigm. He got RVD induction followed by daratumumab, pomalidomide, and dexamethasone, followed by carfilzomib, cyclophosphamide, and then selinexor, bortezomib, dex, and ultimately went on to have a CAR T cell therapy. Did well initially, but had a relapse 18 months after. And then, you know, what we've been doing is patients who don't respond as well to BCMA therapy, we do a little bit of a class switch, and we decided to treat with talquetamab, the anti-GPRC5D bispecific. We did the step-up dosing, which had some grade 1 CRS, which is very common. We gave tocilizumab, no other issues with the initial treatment. But, you know, three cycles in, the patient is coming in saying, listen, you know, look at my hands and feet. The patient is having significant issues with the desquamating rash. They're having pitting nail issues. And the dysgeusia, you know, listen, I think you can only see me from here up. I would like to lose 10 pounds, but you know, when you're going through this and not able to eat, this was very distressing to the patient. Food didn't taste right, couldn't eat. And, you know, a lot of this was, it said, I think I'm losing some weight. And our scale told the truth. The patient had lost 10 pounds in a relatively short amount of time. So dysgeusia was really a big issue. And interestingly enough, in the CTCAE, there is no grade 3 or 4 dysgeusia. So, you know, this all gets marked in the trials as grade 1 and grade 2 because there is no such thing as a grade 3 or 4. But you can have a life-altering grade 1 or grade 2. I had a patient on the initial trial that lost a third of his body weight on this drug. So it can be a real issue. So again, one of the issues that we've noted is that dropping the dose itself, you know, going from 800 to 400 or 400 to 100, that doesn't seem to improve the tolerability. What really seems to do it is stretching out the dose interval. You mentioned belantamab, and that's what we learned from belantamab, that going from 2.5 to 1.5 didn't fix it the way lenalidomide going from 25 to 15 did. But in belantamab, going from every 3 weeks to every 4 or every 6, that improved things. And that's a lot of what we did here. First thing is holding the dose, because patients seem to maintain the response even when you hold. We got a nutrition consult because, you know, I think we still live in a multidisciplinary world, and there's a lot of benefit that our physical therapists can provide, that our nutritionists can provide. Heavy emollients. I like Utterly Smooth and Bag Balm. I think those really help. And we added vitamin E lotion. And then we stretched out the interval from every 2 weeks to every 4 week dosing. And ultimately that led to far better tolerability of the drug. The rash improved. The patient was able to put on some pounds. The other thing, it helps some people, squirting lemon juice or sucking on sour candy before a meal may kind of help the taste buds have food taste a little more right, so people may want to eat. The other thing is suggestion of calorie-dense foods. I always tell people, remember Carnation instant breakfast? You know, instead of mixing it with milk, mix it with ice cream so that every bite you take is maximally dense. And again, here, the biggest lesson that we learned is stretching out the dosing interval really led to better tolerability.
Fascinating. So I wanted to pick your brain a little bit about another thing that I was curious about. I was mentioning before we got started, which is the issue of disparities, you know, the FDA interest in getting people from, you know, various backgrounds and into trials. And particularly, you know, what I started hearing from Paul Richardson starting last summer about the data that was going to be presented from determination at the recent ASH meeting, looking at, you know, it was when it was first reported that the patients, the black patients didn't benefit from transplant. I don't know what people thought. Maybe they thought it had something to do with access to care. And then, you know, they came up with this concept that maybe there's a biologic basis to what's going on. And I really never understood that presentation and that data. And I was hoping you could explain it to me and tell me what it means. I asked Paul a few weeks ago, and he took a shot at it, but I want you to take one too.
Well, not being British, I don't know that my shot will be as eloquent as Paul Richardson's. So part of this is that this wasn't necessarily a pre-planned analysis. So I think we have to be a little careful that, yes, this is what the data shows when we subset everything out. But when you start subset of a subset, it loses some of the statistical power. But yes, the data clearly shows that people of African-American descent, particularly higher BMI patients, didn't seem to do as well with the autograft as they did without the autograft and just RVD alone. Part of this, you know, in terms of overall survival is impossible to evaluate, especially in the U.S. where we have so many options in the relapse that access really does impact how people do. There may be a biological relationship. You know, one of the things that there are connections for is there is an increased rate of diabetes in patients of African and African-American descent. And there may actually be some connections with myelomagenesis as diabetes is an inflammatory state at some level, and that may increase rates of myeloma. There's some ongoing research connecting the two. There may be some drugs that both help diabetes and help prevent progression of myeloma. And it's unclear of whether or not giving high-dose therapy, how that impacts it, whether or not that's from a diabetic inflammation standpoint, whether or not it's from a genomic standpoint. Because one of the things that we know is that high-dose alkylators cause catastrophic genomic instability, chromothripsis and ApoBec, and there may be underlying ethnically based genomic underpinnings that may be more affected by this. This is my long-winded way of saying I don't know the impact. I don't know the cause, but I do know that this is a discussion I have with African and African-American patients, that some of the data may suggest that a transplant may not be as important as part of their treatment modality.
I mean, it really raises the question whether any treatment that we've studied is going to have the same effect. And that's why I was so curious about it, because really that was maybe the first time I've seen a trial that had that kind of finding. And the other thing was that they tried to they brought up the issue of the Duffy Null thing, which I never understood. Mm-hmm. So maybe you can explain to me what Duffy Null is and what that would potentially have to do with this. Are they doing better without the transplant than the, you know, non-Black people, and that's why they don't benefit, or is it they're doing worse? And where does the Duffy Null thing fit in?
I mean, to me, so the Duffy Null thing to me is the most important in terms of trial access. So for those who are not as familiar, there was a condition that had the old name benign ethnic neutropenia. That's the old definition. We don't call it that anymore. They found the phenotype that causes patients of African and African American descent to have a slightly lower white count than people of Caucasian or Asian descent. And one of the biggest things that's impacting is access to trials. You know, we see no increased risk of infection or malignancy in patients that have a lower white count. But if you need an absolute neutrophil count of 1,000 to get on trial and you live at 800 or 900, that's excluding you. So one of the efforts is there's a trial that's undergoing initiation from the MMRF called the Horizon Study, which is seeking to figure out what those normal ranges ought to be for people with Duffy Null to make sure that we don't exclude patients of African and African American descent who just happen to have a slightly lower white blood count.
What you said really makes a lot of sense to me. I think, and particularly, so you're saying that, for example, in that trial, the Duffy Null patient could have gotten excluded because they're neutropenic.
Absolutely. Hmm. And that's one of the reasons why, despite the fact that myeloma is the most common heme malignancy in African and African American patients, African and African American patients seem to continue to represent, in general, fewer than 10% of most clinical trials in myeloma, because, not to mention, part of this is access, but the other part is some patients are excluded because of Duffy Null status and not fitting an arbitrary absolute neutrophil count to gain entrance.
Yeah, I was asking him how he managed to get 19%, or how they managed to get 19% of their patients African American, and I loved his answer, which was that we tried to get African American oncologists and to participate in the trial. Makes a lot of sense, and probably same thing would apply to Hispanic people, etc. So one final thing I just wanted to run by you along the lines of, I don't know, just weird thoughts. I'm curious what you think about. You were talking about inflammation in general as an entity. And I just wanted to share with you an experience I had a couple of weeks ago with Ruben Mesa of myelofibrosis fame. And we were doing a program on myelofibrosis, and he was talking about a couple of negative trials at ASH that didn't improve symptoms compared to ruxolitinib, right? And then I said, well, what about the trial you did looking at Mediterranean diet, randomized? And they showed a difference in myelofibrosis symptoms with that. Now, I'm not, you know, not, it was a small trial, was, you know, but he called it a non-inflammatory diet. You know, it's plant-based, very little fat and meats, et cetera. Any thoughts about whether diet might have some impact on myeloma?
Sure. So I will give credit to Irvi Shah, who's over at Sloan Kettering. She has her Nutrivention trials, which are looking into whether or not, what the impact of dietary changes are in terms of the inflammasome and in terms of how this affects gammopathies. In my mind, I think that by the time you develop full-blown myeloma, changing diet is likely to represent a small component of your outcome relative to the therapies that we choose. However, patients with precursor disorders like MGUS and smoldering, weight loss or less inflammatory diets may have an impact in terms of those rates of progression, because remember, you know, as a long game, you don't need to change the rates that much to push that rate of progression past your survival. So, you know, I always tell people, if I was diagnosed with smoldering myeloma tomorrow, here's the things that I would do. One is I would increase my turmeric and curcumin uptake. I would do that by ordering Indian food and eating lots of samosas because they're delicious. I would never eat sea cucumber because it's, I don't like the taste, but I would hit the gym more often because I think weight loss and reducing total body inflammation may help pre-myeloma disorders prevent them from progressing.
It's really interesting. I guess the thing I was also thinking about was not so much slowing the progression of disease, but maybe having an impact on, you know, some symptomatology, for example, you know, even CRS maybe, I don't know.
No, listen, I think one of the things that we've learned is that, you know, we used to, just like pregnancy, we used to tell, you know, pregnant women, we eat whatever you want. And now the message is, no, you train for it like you train for a marathon. And I think there's some component of this with especially long-term chronic cancer therapy is that the better fit you are globally will probably impact symptoms and may even impact outcomes, you know, increasing exercise, better sleep, better nutritional health. It can only help in a lot of these scenarios.
Are there trials looking, you know, at the earlier stage disease, looking at lifestyle interventions out there?
Yeah, one of Irvi Shah's nutrivention studies is looking at it. The difficulty with some of these studies is that, you know, if we take MGUS, which has a rate of progression of around 1% per year, these are the type of trials that you're going to need potentially years, if not decades, to show the impact. And beyond that, it's a little hard to control for dietary indiscretions. I say that as I'm thinking about cookies as we speak. It's hard to control for that over a long period of time.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Richter, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.